It requires so much vulnerability to do this work, and not everyone can do it and has the guts to do it. So if you're on this journey and you are writing, you're a writer. You can call yourself a capital W writer, and yeah, keep going, and you're doing amazing. Just keep going.
Hello and welcome to The New Writers' Room, a podcast for emerging writers. My name is Caitlin Chang and I'm editor at SBS Voices. Now, it has been a minute since we've dropped an episode of The New Writers' Room, and a lot has happened in the last few weeks. So we wanted to jump into our virtual studio and have a bit of a debrief of this year's SBS Emerging Writers competition ahead of the winner's announcement. And for today's discussion, I'm joined by SBS Voices journalist, writer, and presenter, Sarah Malik. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Caitlin. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you for being on your very first episode of The New Writers' Room.
Oh my God, thank you for having me. I have my chai ready. I'm very excited. I can't wait to just yabber on like I do in the office, but actually we have an excuse to. We have a podcast now, so I am like ready.
Yes, let's get into it. So Sarah, you and I were lucky enough to read some of this year's entries as part of the long listing panel for the SBS Emerging Writers Competition. So we got a bit of a sneak peek into some of the excellent stories before they were sent along to the official competition judges, Tara June Winch and Behrouz Bachani. So I'm curious, first of all, to get your, you know, thoughts on what stood out for you this year. I mean, this is the second year of the competition. So what were some of the things you loved about this year's entries?
I think what I really love about long listing, and this is the second year that I've done it, and I've spoken to you, the team, before about this, is I really feel like long listing, where you're reading hundreds of entries that come from across all of Australia, it's this rare opportunity and this rare insight into Australia as it is today. I kind of call it the census, you know, not in a statistical sense, but in, I think there's a quote someone said that anecdotes is just data in plural, you know?
Yeah.
And I just feel like reading all of these entries is kind of like a snapshot of Australia, of modern Australia, of the stories that I think need to be told, a barometer of society and what people are feeling, what people are thinking, their relationships, modern day Australia, an Australia that we often don't see reflected in mainstream arts, mainstream media, you know, on Neighbours, on TV, but that is the evolving picture of what this country is in 2021. And it's just a huge privilege and a huge honour to be able to get that insight and to receive those stories and to, yeah, be a receptacle for those kinds of inner worlds, you know, for people to really feel comfortable enough to share that. And I feel like these are the stories that need to be told today and in the future to give us a picture of what Australia is and what it's becoming.
Just quickly, I want to give a bit of a disclaimer that, you know, we are going to discuss the competition today and some of the stories that we loved. We actually don't know who the winner is yet. So the stories that we discussed today, they might not necessarily be in the shortlist, but we just thought they were so impressive and worth talking about and highlighting. So I just wanted to get that out of the way before we kind of do a deep dive. Mm-hmm. So I thought there was a really interesting range of interpretations of the theme Between Two Worlds this year. We saw everyone from prisoners to trans and non-binary writers. We had sex workers sending in stories, refugees, and even a couple of 90-year-olds submit their stories. And there was also a really great representation of First Nations writers too. So how did the theme Between Two Worlds work for you? What did you think worked well with that theme?
I think the great thing about this theme, and I think you touched on it with last year's theme, I think people took it very literally. So it was a great theme, but it was, you know, growing up in diverse Australia and there was those themes that were replicated like lunchboxes and being different in the schoolyard and getting teased and that kind of thing. But I think the theme for this year, Between Two Worlds, was interpreted in a more abstract way. And I think it allowed for a lot more creativity because it wasn't necessarily, it didn't have to be based on culture or identity. It could just be a story that encapsulates that theme in any way. So it really allowed people that scope and movement and that flexibility. And it didn't pigeonhole them in any way. It was what stories are out there that you want to tell and tell them in any way that makes sense to you. And that could be you're between two worlds, you know, generationally. You know, there's a lot of stories about people having these gulfs with their parents, and which is, you know, like this generation gulf, complicated relationships between two worlds in terms of class, between two worlds in terms of this world and kind of a dreamlike world or a digital world, or this life and another life in terms of the space between life and death and spiritual experiences. And so I think that the fact that between two worlds was this really abstract theme, it really allowed people the flexibility to interpret that in a creative way. So not just literally, but emotionally or psychologically or using metaphors.
One of the things that really struck me this year was as the theme moved, I guess, beyond culture and identity, there were a lot of stories from writers who shared their experiences with chronic illness. So stories about living with endometriosis, living with migraines, with, you know, eating disorders. There was one really exceptional piece that I read where the writer, I guess, had been diagnosed with a particular chronic illness in her young adult life. So the idea of the between two worlds was the well and the unwell world. It was really emotional and it kind of made me quite teary because the way she described her world getting smaller as she got more sick was really moving.
Mm-hmm. Like you said, the themes varied so much and the tone of the themes. So, you know, there was light and there was shade and there was a lot of, you know, deep emotional personal stories shared. And there was a lot of lightness. You know, I remember really kind of lolling at a story about a young woman talking about being a hairy Lebanese girl in country Australia, you know, and I just loved it because there's so much of, you know, the iconography of Australia and our ideas of Australiana, especially the country and the bush, and a lot of that literature around the bush is so white, you know, and that's the assumption that we make, that, you know, country Australia or bush Australia is this classic Australia, white Australia. I mean, that's actually not true. You know, so many of the people I read were writers of colour or queer writers who come from really varied places, not just in the city, you know, from small towns, from rural and regional areas. And, you know, talking about what it's like, that dislocation when you're the only type of person in a particular place. You find yourself growing up in a small place with, you know, where you're the only, you know, outsider, and approaching that in a really humorous way and with some levity. I think another thing with the census point is that a lot of people feel alone in their experiences, and getting this collection of stories makes me realize how common some experiences are. And I think one of those was the where are you from question.
Yeah.
You know, it's such a fraught question. And I think I compare this question to why don't you smile or put a smile on your face? Because the person who asks this question often is bewildered and confused at how it can cause offense. And for a woman who, you know, lives in a male-dominated society and you are constantly told to be ornamental or to be happy or to kind of modulate yourself in a particular way so that your anger or your complicated emotions are kind of erased, that can be enraging to be told that by a random stranger, to be told what to do with your face. And where are you from was a similar question that I just loved reading these stories. And there's a particular line that I want to share. The reason why I titled this article, Where Are You From? Is because it is the most frequent question I have ever been asked in my life. To get a snapshot of how frequent, when I worked at Coles as a cashier for 5 years, on an average shift, I would be asked that question 5 times. I had 4 shifts a week. There are 52 weeks in a year. 5 times 4 is 20. 20 times 52 is 1,040. I have formulated an answer to this question. I can't just say Queensland because almost every time I do, I either get perceived as someone who isn't fluent in English or insolent. This is because the real question most people are secretly asking is, why do you look Asian? And I just thought, gosh, that she really got it, you know. And I felt like it was a siphon for my own confusion and rage around that whole topic. And often if you discuss that with other people, you get a lot of clap back for being sensitive or being a snowflake. But the fact that that was affirmed through some of the stories I read made me feel less alone in that experience.
The other thing which really stuck out for me, which is kind of similar, is this idea of code switching. So, you know, actually being between two worlds and I guess existing within the liminal space between two cultures. There were a lot of stories about writers sharing their experiences of being mixed race, but also the experience of, I guess, being of a culture, but then also being white passing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was a really interesting and enlightening piece by a young Indigenous writer. She writes about her experience as a trainee doctor in a rural hospital. And I guess the tension that she felt being between the world of like working and existing within this, you know, medical institution and an establishment and her culture as a First Nations woman.
Mm-hmm.
And she wrote a really great intro, which I just wanted to quickly share. Here I stand again at the edge of this portal, decorated with glowing white lights. Every day for the past 2 weeks, I've hesitated at its entrance, whilst others who look exactly like me walk through without even a second thought. Every day I've stepped through, my mind and my world is sawn in two.
Yeah, I love this story, Caitlin, and I think it's because it encapsulates between two worlds again in so many multiple ways. So there's not only that, you know, between white Australia and being, you know, a black person in a white environment, but it's also the class divide, you know, between classes. And I think anyone who has been the first person to do something in their family or their community, first person to go to the university, first person to be in a profession, first person to be in all of these environments that, you know, everyone else seems to know what they're doing and exist with a kind of ease, but you're just treading water furiously while trying to give the mirage of being, you know, smiling on the outside.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the other themes which I wanted us to talk about was just the sheer number of stories we got from LGBTIQ plus writers. You know, we had a lot of writers who are trans or non-binary who had some really great experiences of being between two worlds. So I wondered if any stories stood out for you from kind of that cohort of entrants.
Definitely. There were some incredible stories. There was a particular non-binary writer who talked about growing up in country Australia and just not fitting in and what that's like when you leave and you come back and how you are constantly adjusting yourself to the way others perceive you and how you internalize that gaze and how you can reclaim that gaze. And, you know, as a Muslim woman, I really relate to this story, strangely. So I just want to read a little excerpt from it first and then talk about the gaze issue, which I think is a really big one when you're someone who is visibly different sure. in some way, whether it's you're a hijabi or you just present in a way that's non-normative.
Yeah,
I think that's the best way to say it. So the quote I'm just going to read out now, it just starts like this. I'm a far cry from the country daughter that moved to the city 5 years ago. To say I've struggled with my identity growing up would be an understatement, but I became public and became visible very early in my life. My queerness was often in the local newspaper, in the news, it followed me at school. My visibility as a queer person in a rural area was not under my own power. I was always that one, obvious to everyone, especially people I had never met.
Hmm.
And then this quote. The irony of being gawked at from a young age is that you never truly feel seen. And that for me, now that I'm older, I demand to be visible.
Hmm.
So I thought that was really powerful because you stick out like a sore thumb and people do see you, but they don't actually see you.
And what I really liked about this is when they, you know, got older and they're demanding to be visible, the writer was essentially planting a flag and saying, this is who I am. You know, I'm not going to feel that shame anymore.
Yes, yes. I think that's the powerful thing. It's whatever the stories are, whatever their tone, whether they're dark or light or funny or somber, just the act of writing, just the act of saying, here I am, and this is my voice, and this is who I am, is so radical. It's so powerful. So I think yeah. if you went out there and you wrote your story and you submitted it, bravo to you. Honestly, yes. bravo to you. It's such a huge thing. And the whole gaze issue and that nervousness and the idea that you're always preempting yourself in environments, preempting and walking on eggshells in a way, and being different people in different environments. I think that was definitely a big theme. Yeah. The double lives and secrecy and shame, and what that does to you internally. Like, how does that affect your self-esteem? How does that affect your confidence and that your sense of yourself and how you move through the world? And I think that those stories really lived with me and really spoke to me in a really powerful way.
Yeah, and another topic which came up again and again in the competition, which I think speaks to having Behrouz Bachani as one of our judges, was stories from refugees and asylum seekers about their experience. One standout piece that I read was from a young woman who spent some time on Nauru and she eventually settled in Australia.
Also, I think that she's really honest about some of the exhaustion of that and how great it is to kind of escape sometimes your story and how that shouldn't just define you. That's just one aspect of who you are. So I think I might, if we have time, read a bit of an excerpt on this. Yeah. I didn't want to lie, but I was just tired of always being interviewed by everyone. That because I was a refugee, I should have the story of my life always ready for other people to know on demand, that I had to fit in with the presumptions people had about refugees. And I usually don't fit with them. Or worse, being involuntarily nominated as a representative of everyone who has ever come to this country to seek asylum. Someone once said, any sentence that includes you people isn't going to be a good one. I was tired of those sentences, so I would hide behind a mediocre lie about myself. But in my notebook, I was a body possessed by flashbacks that were hungry to materialize on pages. No matter how much I would try and hide, sometimes there was no escape.
Hmm.
And such a like beautiful paragraph that really talked about the exhaustion, you know, of carrying that with you and how much sometimes that's not even a choice. You know, she goes on to talk about how, you know, as an undocumented person getting her license, she started panicking because the lady who was her driving instructor required, you know, a passport and she didn't have one, you know, and she felt panicked because she didn't know how this person would respond to the fact that she was a refugee. And that emotional vulnerability, living with that vulnerability that you could be revealed at any time. Like, I think because she mentioned this, you know, in the article she writes, the lady was not impressed. Later on, she sent me to someone else. But before that, she yelled out, she doesn't have a passport. Loud enough for the whole white room to hear and turn their heads to me, pressing the bleeding wound, I wondered, when would the punishments ever end? So it's this bleeding wound that people are holding there, you know, in their work. And so you also just want to hold it with them, you know, but also want to be like to them, take care of that. You know, it's precious.
Yeah.
Did you feel like that, Caitlin, like that you felt their vulnerability and also wanted to somehow protect the writers at the same time?
Yeah, definitely. Like, it can be hard to read these stories, but it also, I don't know, I feel really lucky to be able to kind of get this insight into these hard experiences, but they're real and it's real life. And I wanted to talk about one more aspect of some of the entries, which was there were some really interesting and exciting interpretations of the theme.
Yeah.
So there was one example where a writer is writing about playing video games with the presence of his father, who's actually passed away. So it's between two worlds of the living and the dead. And he's writing about having these mental conversations with him while playing video games. And there was this really nice line where he says, he introduced me to basic Arabic literacy and grammar. I taught him how to handle a controller.
Yeah, I love this story. It was so trippy. It was dreamlike. It was this imagined conversation with this lost father who he kind of experiences as this blue light, you know, in the room. And I really love this interpretation of Between Two Worlds because it was literally felt like between two worlds, between this world and another world, between life and death, between the digital world and the real world, which I thought was really also a great interpretation of that because we live in a world that is so mediated by the internet. And I think that that means that we're often in lots of different rabbit holes. You know, we exist with our own entertainment and our own news and our own games and And this story actually reminded me of a story that was in The New Yorker by Jamil Kochai, who's an amazing Afghan-American writer. And, you know, he writes about playing a video game to be connected to his Afghan heritage and kind of seeing his parents' homeland in a video game. But in the video game, the Afghans are the baddies. Mm. So it was just this powerful way of him trying to connect with his heritage, but also doing it from this American video game perspective. And I think this story really kind of had that same vibe, you know, that he was in this world of this video game. And I think that he ends it beautifully. He says, "I pan the room. Now sitting alone on the couch, I tried to find the root of the question marks that sat either side of me. The imagined presence of my ancestor disappeared, and I attempted to revisit my self-construction. I met the void that had been settling in my footsteps since I was a dark-skinned boy, before I grew into a South African, Indian, British, Australian Muslim. The void lay in between the decontextualized minarets I rested on, as my Amins became I mean, Dada Baji now departed, and I was left with the legacy of lostness, a skin inscribed by sun in illegible letters." And just beautiful writing there as well, Caitlin.
Yeah, that's beautiful. So, Sarah, now we've discussed some of our favorite themes from this year. So my number one piece of advice is just to keep going. Between now and next year, when the entries for next year's competition open, just keep writing. Just, you know, keep practicing. You know, it's a craft. Yeah, that would be my number one piece of advice. Sarah, what about you?
Yeah, oh my gosh, that I think is the key one. Don't get this in heart, and bravo to you if you submitted. That is amazing. You should be so proud of yourself because, you know, it's writing is just, it's a practice. It's something you got to keep on doing. Nothing is ever wasted. You know, you work on one thing, it can become something else. You can keep crafting it. Something that you, you know, wrote a year ago or a few years ago, you can come back to and use it in another way. So just keep going, keep writing, and keep, keep your spirits up, you know, because I think a lot of it is, you know, it's a rejection game. You know, you can get so many failures before you get a success. And sometimes you want those failures because you're not ready, you know, and you want to be able to hone it. And, you know, sometimes I look back at some of my work and I'm like, thank God that didn't go anywhere. It's like, oh my gosh, like it just was not ready. But the fact that you're writing and you're out there and you're doing it is just incredible. And I think every writer goes through that process, you know, so it is a process and keep going. And, you know, there are some tips that Caitlin and I did have that are good things to keep in mind just so, you know, you're not kind of being felled by really basic things that you could do to nail it. You know, so for me, Caitlin, a lot of it was, and I know this advice gets given a lot and I also struggle to practice it, but I can't stress it enough. It's the show and don't tell. It's just so key. Paint a scene because the scene reveals more about the people and the events and what you're trying to express than, you know, a treatise. So one story that really stood out for me that I did this really well was a story about a young woman who's going back home with her partner who she's introducing to her family. And at the dinner party, at the dinner table, sorry, her father, who is so charming at the dinner table, but is quite an abusive man, verbally abusive man, that gets revealed through the interaction at the dinner table. So he's charming to the new partner, but as soon as her brother walks in and, you know, you can see his low self-esteem, his shoulder crumpling, he's sitting at the table and the dad just barks at him and, you know, says, "Eat your food," or something like that. And everyone is just silent, you know, at that moment where he's just viciously attacks his son. And you can see him dropping, his shoulders dropping, and no one says anything. And then they leave and there's this silent understanding between her and her partner that, yeah, this is my family. And I think that that says more about what it's like growing up in a household where there is domestic abuse than anything. You know, that scene that was painted about that dinner table interaction, I felt that was just so powerful. And And if you think about those moments or those scenarios and you can kind of paint them in your story.
Yeah, I think it's part of that in terms of, like, I guess, setting the scene and creating a scene and showing, not tell, is clarity. So it's a really important element of storytelling. Readers don't like being confused. So, yeah, it needs to be quite straightforward what you're trying to convey. Don't overcomplicate things. You know, by all means, make the story beautiful, use beautiful language. But the moment the story gets confusing or too convoluted, you've lost your reader. So that's just something really important to keep in mind. Making something clear doesn't mean it has to be simplistic.
Mm-hmm. And it's not easy to do. People think simple is easy. Simple is hard.
Yeah.
Simple is actually really hard. Like, flow and clarity and not too much at the dinner plate, you know, yeah. Like, just make your roast really great. You know,
yeah.
You have a limited amount of words and you need to draw people in that first part, and you don't need to tell your whole life story. Focus on a scene or a moment, draw people in with that first part, because that's what you have with this limited word count. You know, you want to draw them in and give the good stuff. And I think also edit. That is a huge thing. I think there were so many stories that were, all the elements were there. They just needed to be reshuffled a bit and cut and yep. pruned. And I know that when you're submitting stuff, it's just you're procrastinating and you're stressed and you're like, I'm just going to get it in. I'm just going to throw it in the basket. But just take that time, like just take those few hours or that day, or just to read it, you know, read it and read it out loud to someone, give it to someone. Just have a read, and when you're kind of more calm, and just see how it flows as someone who hasn't read it, you know, like give yourself fresh eyes and do that pruning just so the narrative and the structure kind of just flow and you get that feeling of pace and, oh, you know, then there's no gaps left for the reader. So I think giving yourself a bit of distance and doing that editing is also a really key thing to making sure that your story really sings.
Yeah. So I think that's one thing which writers, I guess, can get stuck on. You can have like an amazing start, an amazing kind of first half to a piece where, you know, it all kind of just flows out of you and comes really naturally. But then when it comes to, I guess, wrapping things up, and I'm the same, you can really, I guess, struggle to stick the landing. So I know when I'm writing, sometimes you want to just kind of get to the end. So you, I guess, bash out the last kind of 300 words. And there were a lot of really beautiful stories that sort of fell apart in the last 200 words. So I guess my advice would be to kind of take a minute and take a breath and, you know, don't rush towards the finish line. The main thing with storytelling is that there needs to be, you know, there's a complication and there's a tension and then there's also a resolution. So this doesn't mean that it has to be a happy ending, but do you think the reader is going to be satisfied when they get to the end of your story, or are there going to be questions they're wondering? And, you know, have you carried through with the themes?
Like, sit there yeah. and just, you know, think it through. You're right, there's nothing more unsatisfying than, just think of it as someone who's telling a story at the dinner table. You know, you want to like get right in there with the hook, and you don't want it to peter out. You know, you want it to keep the pace going, and then you want it to have you know, the sensation of you're filled at the end of it, you know. So I think this also is a reminder that, yes, it's your story, but it's writing and craft. A memoir is still craft. It's still art that you need to shape and mold in a particular way. Yes, it's based on your real experiences, but it is a creation. You know, Roxane Gay talks about this. There's this idea that somehow there's a disrespectful idea that somehow memoir is not art, or that, you know, just because it's a true experience, it doesn't require talent or creativity or skill. But it actually does. It requires a huge amount of skill, because what you're doing is you're siphoning those experiences, you're creating a scene around those experiences, you're using words to convey that experience, and you're evoking a mood or a response in the reader. So it's an active process. It's a work that you're doing to shape that. And so don't forget that it's not just your experience, but it's how you're conveying that experience. And you're using all the tools in your handy box, which is your words, your structure, your pace, and bringing all those paragraphs together.
Yeah. What's going to get the cut through? And just, I guess, on that, you know, thinking about how you would tell this story to your friend. An extension of that is, you know, think about who the audience is. Who are you writing this story for? So there's almost a default to feel like you have to write for a white audience,
mm-hmm.
Which means that you know, writers often feel like they need to include translations or provide kind of asides and examples of, you know, culturally specific elements to their stories, which, you know, sometimes that's warranted, but often it can, I guess, interfere with the pacing of a story and it can be jarring. So question whether you need to kind of offer translations for the Mandarin word for grandfather, or, you know, you can kind of let that stuff wash over a reader sometimes as well. And that's quite nice.
Oh, I love that. And I think that is just such a wonderful point to make, Caitlin, you know, that giving permission, you know, because often writers, minority writers, don't feel like they have that permission and they're always translating themselves and they've internalized this idea that they need to do that because the audience or the publishers or the editors or the arts industry or whatever is white, you know. And so it's this internal gaze that becomes censoring, and that you're doing that in your work. And to lose that and just to be given permission to be like, just assume the judges are just understand everything you're going to say. You know, they understand who Gung Gung is, you know, yeah. They understand that that's granddad, you know, and you don't need to put the italics. And I think that so much of literature is moving in that way in terms of understanding that English language is fluid and register is fluid. And we saw that with Bernardine Evarista's work in terms of how that girl, woman, other, how that changed register and added different cadences. And so I think this idea that this upper class, tough, white English, British English is the English, we're moving away from all of that. And it's just, it's lovely that we're just, I know literature is moving towards incorporating and encapsulating all those changes in registers and language and rhythm in a more fluid way. So please feel free to do that. I think that that's something that is energetic and exciting.
Yeah. Okay. And above all, my advice for next year is just to enter again. Just write another story.
Yeah, just keep going. Keep entering. Keep going. Honestly.
You know, and as Tara June Winch, one of our judges, said when she appeared on this podcast, you've all got a story inside you. So, you know, it's all about finding your voice. And I just wanted to play a little quote actually from Tara about finding your voice.
It's there. It lives inside you. It's the voice at 3 a.m. that's telling you to live a better life. It's all your regret, all your guilt, all your shame. It's that love you can't let go of. It's your first absolutely soul-destroying heartbreak. You know, that is your voice.
That quote is just so beautiful. I think it's one of those things that you should just write out and tape above your study desk.
Yes.
Because it requires so much vulnerability to do this work, and not everyone can do it and has the guts to do it. So if you're on this journey and you are writing, you're a writer. You can call yourself a capital W writer. And yeah, keep going. And you're doing amazing. Just keep going.
Yes. And bravo. Bravo to you.
Bravo.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today. It was so valuable to get your insights. You're always so insightful. I love talking to you about writing and storytelling.
Thank you so much for having me on. It was brilliant.
The New Writers' Room is produced by Caitlin Chang and audio produced by Jeremy Wilmot. Our executive producers are Natalie Hambley and Danielle Teutsch. You can find SBS Voices on Facebook or on Twitter. And if you'd like to pitch a story to us, you can email voices@sbs.com.au. The official anthology of the 2020 SBS Emerging Writers Competition is out now at all good bookshops. Roots, Home is Who We Are, published by Hardy Grant Books in partnership with SBS, features 30 of the best entries to inspire you to get writing.